One.
Chris, the topic we'll be discussing today is, how do you handle player horses / mounts?
Ooh, you kill them off immediately. Hello and welcome to Roll for Topic, a roundtable discussion about topics related to running role-playing games. I'm Chris Salzman.
And I'm Andy Rao.
Andy, so this is a really fun question because I know we've been chatting. We both restarted Elden Ring. You're much further along than I am. But for those of you who haven't played Elden Ring, very early on in the game, basically like as soon as you get control of your character and get out of the tutorial section, they give you this really cool mount that you can summon, the spectral like horse thing named Torrent that you can summon at any time in the game, which is really fun. And it very much changes the experience, I think, of playing that game, because like you're just like immediately have your cool horse. It's like you don't have to do anything else.
The best part of it is that it has double jump for like no in-game explained reason. Like they could have just programmed it to jump really high, but instead they're like, we're not going to do that. We're going to have it jump normal, but it can do it just twice. It cracks me up every time I double jump with the horse. So.
It's so great. Yeah. And there's my other favorite part about that horse is there's just these like, I don't know, like tornado wind tunnel things that like allow you to jump super high.
Yes.
There's just like, I don't know. It's like Elden Ring in a lot of ways feels like a collection of just as much fantasy nonsense that you want to put together and throw into one game. But it's just totally. Like, everything about it is so delightful. Like just running around, you call your horse with your cool whistle, you know, appears below you, and then you can just start dashing and jumping. Yeah, it's good.
Yes. Well, I know you have some stuff we wanted to get to before the topic, but this is already giving me stuff I want to say about mounts and what they might look like in role-playing games. So, but I'm gonna push that to the side. What else did you want to hit on before we dive into our topic here?
Yeah. So the only thing I want to hit on is so people have been listening to the podcast for the past, a handful of episodes or so, will probably know that I've been reading The Hobbit with my daughter. So she's 9 years old. This is her first time through The Hobbit. We just finished it up like 2 days ago or so. So I asked her as soon as we were done, I was like, did you like it? She's like, I loved it, which was good news. As I've joked before, it's sort of, it's required reading to be in my family to have read The Hobbit and sort of understand it. There's just too many references to it that float around from day to day.
Were you just sweating when you asked her if she liked it? Because she didn't know the consequences that would happen if she answered wrong.
Yes. Yeah. A little bit. I mean, I was fine with her not enjoying it. And there were definitely parts where it sort of dragged for her, especially the last third of the book is really just like a giant description of a battle, which maybe doesn't hold the 9-year-old's interest as it might a middle-aged man's interest.
Yeah.
That book is just phenomenal. I think for me too, right? It had been a long time since I'd read it. So getting to that, like the Battle of the Five Armies sort of at the end of it, like seeing how all that stuff was seeded throughout the story to get to that point. It's just like, this is what Tolkien does so well that I think a lot of people credit him for, but a lot of people like try to do and they just can't quite get there. It's just like, there's like all these little moments where the characters are making this decision sort of in the story, right? That then come back to sort of either bite them or to make things more complicated or to make things easier for them to, as they're going through it, and especially at the end. I really enjoyed it. Super fun book. You could cut six of the dwarves and it would be the same story. It's like, but we're glad that they're there. It's a fun one.
That's awesome. I'm sorry. I need to beat this joke a little bit more. I've just got this picture of like, while you're asking your kid, is she like The Hobbit? Your wife is like quietly slipping like a gum Jabbar out of her pocket or something, just in case.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you grow up watching that Rankin Bass Hobbit movie?
No. Okay. No, and so I wasn't really aware of it. You mentioned it to me recently. So we have a copy of it. So we started watching that last night. So we're gonna, it'll take us a couple days to get through it just because of how things are with our life, so my plan is she has to watch that one first, and then we'll watch the Peter Jackson trilogy. Still don't know why it's a trilogy, but the trilogy after that. She will like never want to watch the cartoon ever again, but I'm sure she'll love the Hobbit movies.
We kind of stalled out at the end of Hobbit movie number two because we've been trying to watch through them, me and my son. And here's my recommendation for you. If your kid is pretty young, you might want to consider like cherry picking some scenes. Because there's a lot of, I don't want to be the irritating fan criticizing the movies or whatever, but there are some scenes in there that like just delighted my son like crazy. And then there's some long stretches where it's just a struggle. I could see him struggling to keep engaged. Yeah. So like the hobbits or the dwarves throwing plates around at the beginning, you know, like my son was shrieking with laughter through that entire sequence. So
yeah,
there's some fun pieces, but you, given the length of those, you might want to consider like cherry picking some scenes.
That's a good point. But my main memory of the last movie, and we'll stop talking about, this is not a movie podcast. You've got one of those, but yeah, my main memory of the third movie is Thorin just spending like basically half the runtime kind of like wandering around looking for the Arkenstone and being sad about the Arkenstone. It's just like at a certain point you're like, did we really need like any of these these scenes? Yeah. Like
well, and again, okay, so this isn't the movie podcast, but I just can't help myself. Like, it is just interesting to me. Thorin's story is emotional and impactful in the book, and it gets like what, a hundredth of the like screen time that the movie gives it, like, and I think the movie correctly understands that his character flaws are like one of the book's compelling like through lines. And so I think the movie was right to focus on that. But at the same time, focusing on it to that extent, like, it didn't add to the power of Thorin being who he is and realizing only at the end, understanding his own character accurately only at the end. I mean, that's a really moving scene in the book. And I don't know.
Yeah, it just doesn't quite hit in the movies for some reason. Reading it now, I think what stuck out to me was basically it's not until that end when Thorin apologizes to Bilbo that they fully trust each other. Like, throughout the entire book, like, no one sort of trusts Bilbo, right? Like, no one trusts the Hobbit. It's like sort of dwarves versus Hobbit, and like, you can almost see there's like a, I don't know, like a very video game style like tracker of like trust to distrust going back and forth based on sort of actions and things that that Bilbo's able to do, right? Like, they meet those trolls like right like early on in it, and like Bilbo totally bungles up that whole thing, and like at that point you're like, they're gonna throw him out like throw him out of the party, but like Gandalf, I'm sure, Gandalf steps in, right? So, like, it's like you almost have, like, Gandalf, like, coming in to sort of correct the behavior, like, the arguments between them to, like, bring them back together just enough for them to go to the next stage of the journey, and then Gandalf goes off and does something else and then comes back, and, like, there's discord again, and they're trying to get them back together like that. It's interesting to me because I think there is a tendency, at least in the games that I run, is that, like, I want all the players to sort of be, like, friends, the characters to be friends that at the table. But like some of these really interesting and compelling stories like The Hobbit, like there's actually a high level of distrust and a little bit of like disharmony even in the group. Right. It's going like, you know, like Bilbo's sort of along for the ride. He gets to the end of it and he's like, I don't actually want the thing that everybody else wants out of this. Like, I just want to go back home. Like, you can keep the gold. Like, I don't care at this point. And it's like, you know, he was sort of there for the adventure, you know, and the journey, and like, but the dwarves were very much there for what's at the end at the end of it, you know. It's just like it's really interesting for like I call it a children's story. I don't totally think it's a kid's book, but like kid's book to have like these very complicated motivations going on, you know, in there. Like you mentioned with Thorin, like, right, he has this whole arc that he goes through as well, like, and you know, it's a very like kingly arc, I guess, if you will, right? Like, he for him it's like the gold and the treasure is one thing, but it's also taking back the mountain is the other thing. I think some of the other dwarves probably they're just there for the treasure, you know, and Bilbo's along for the ride. Gandalf is trying to make things happen in the world, to, you know, sort of right some wrongs and like good triumph over evil, that sort of stuff. But yeah, it's a fascinating book to me because it is like this fun little story, then there's this giant battle at the end of it, but then there's all this like other stuff happening that you can sort of miss in the like the dwarves being silly.
My mind went to when you were talking about the Bilbo kind of slowly gaining and maybe sometimes losing like a positive relationship with Thorin and the dwarves based on what's happening in the story. I have a sequence coming up in the game in my home game where the players, I'm trying to figure out how to do this. Like the players are going to be turned loose into a fairly sandbox situation, but their goal is they need to gain the trust. I'm just going to be vague here. The trust and acceptance of like an authority figure. And the way they do that is they need to go out and in the sandbox, they need to do a bunch of stuff demonstrating their trustworthiness or their goodness. They don't have to do all of it, but they have to do enough of it to kind of accumulate like, okay, you guys are good guys. You're on my team. And so I've just been thinking like how the extent to which I make that relationship, like a number that I'm tracking, like, and if I'm making it a gamey number, like you have to get to relationship level 20 with this guy. And each of these little side quests you do will give you, you know, 4 points. And if you do, you know, if you screw up a side quest, you only get 2 points, you know, do I want to game it out like that? And if I'm going to game it like that, do I just straight up tell the players like, here's all the things you can do. Here's like the point value they'll add to your relationship. I'll let you guys figure out which of these strategize, which of these you want to do. You know, is that fun or is that too mechanical? You know, am I taking away, should I just freeform it? Like, you know, I feel like you guys have over the last month of game nights, you guys have demonstrated your loyalty and he is okay with you. So I don't know if that was a logical thing to get from your Hobbit talk, but do you have any quick thoughts about that?
How might
you handle that?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I don't think I might have the sort of the table written up of like, you know, point values to nice things that you can do for them. Yeah. I don't think I would share it with the players unless you're going to lean very hard on mechanics at that point. Cause I think then it turns into a numbers game and they're thinking sort of less about the role playing at that point. It's like, oh, we got to do a thing that gives us whatever 5 points. So we got to look through the list to find the thing and do it that way. But I mean, I think there's some merit to having that. And I think I would also have a handful of things on there that can sort of like critically fail or critically succeed on those, like with one action, right? Like if you picked me up at the airport at 3 a.m, like I trust you for the rest of my life, right? Yes. You know, like something like that, you know, versus like if, you know, you told me you'd pick me up at the airport at, you know, 10 a.m. like on a weekend and you didn't show up, like, right? Like that would be like, how do I trust you ever again, right? Because I think like that's more how friendships and relationships happen, I think, is like sometimes it's just, you can just do like the one nice thing and you'll forever have like good feelings about that person and give them the benefit of the doubt from there on out. Yeah, and I think that's probably like just evolutionarily that's a good move for us to do that, so we don't have to constantly reprove ourselves over and over to everybody. But yeah, so I mean, I think there's some fun stuff you could do there. I mean, you might also like, I think if you're going to think about it in terms of, are you going to think about it in terms of like scenes that they can do with them or this like stuff that they have to do as they're going along?
It's more just like, here's this region of the world. It needs a lot of help. Mm-hmm. So if you pitch in enough to show that you're like really good people and valuable to have around, you'll have earned the trust of the person. So it's, you know, this old lady needs help crossing the street. So that's a quick little encounter. Or there's like goblins have taken over the town hall and, you know, it's a full multi-hour dungeon crawl to clear them out. You know, like a range of stuff like that.
Yeah. Is there anything about Diablo, like the Diablo quests? Like, you know, like you have some of those things where sometimes it's just like you're bringing something to, you know, you're doing like a fetch quest or you're, you know, finding someone, bringing someone else somewhere, you know, or going out to clear out a dungeon, like that sort of stuff. I mean, so like there's probably a fun way I think you could present that to the players to where it doesn't feel like it's just a mechanical, like here's some numbers. Like I'm almost thinking like, is there like a way to frame it as like a skill tree or like a chart or a clock or something like that, that removes a little bit of just the pure numbers, but also gives them a very clear indication of like how they're progressing in this, especially if that's their goal, right? If their goal is to win this person over, like maybe having having like the thermometer that you're filling in as uh-huh. like they're you know yeah. giving donations or whatever. Like, you know, having something like that could actually be pretty fun for them.
I just tend to overthink these things. When I think about, like, you know, whatever, do I have the thermometer at the game table mm-hmm. and I fill it yeah. in, or a clock that I'm filling in pies of the clock, which I yeah. love clocks. Well, aren't clocks more fun when there's like a, you know, a competing pressure, mm-hmm. right? There's another clock that's filling up, whatever, the Lord is getting impatient with you clock mm-hmm. that's yeah. filling up at the same time. And, you know, but the more complicated you get, I think the more the players ought to know the details of how you're figuring this stuff out. So that, mm-hmm. you know, the more transparency I think you need to have. And well, that's good for that. I'll let you know how I end
yeah.
up
in the yeah. future episode. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, like I feel like Blades in the Dark does this pretty well with like clocks, but also weaving them into role playing as well, right? So like there are like just times at which you're just sort of rolling to see how many little sections you're going to fill in on the clock,
yeah,
right? Like, so you can do that, but then I think there's going to be like the description of what you did and how it did that, right? Like, that's where like some fun role playing can happen. Still yeah. too, like, I mean, I'm sure there is a way to play, I think, Blades in the Dark where like there's almost no narrative back and forth, but I think you miss out on a ton of stuff if there's not
yes,
a description absolutely. Of like, oh, like, I'm gonna do this project to, I don't know, start building a bridge between this town and that town, right? So the GM's like, well, that's gonna take you, you know, 10, like, it's gonna be a 10 segment clock, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so like every time you're rolling, then you can just say, oh, like, you get the right permit, or you get the right building materials, or like whatever that is, right? Like, I think you can kind of explain that yeah, explain the mechanical in terms of role playing. Like, that's going to be the more interesting part.
Well, awesome. Yeah. Shall we dive into our topic of mounts?
Yes. Yes, let's
please do that. I can't stop thinking about the mount in Elden Ring.
Yeah.
Traditionally, do you tend to have players in like a D&D type game that have a mount? And let's maybe expand it a little bit. Maybe like some sort of a mount, like an animal companion type of thing mm-hmm. that's more than just pure flavor.
Yeah, I'm thinking about like warlock characters that have had like familiars in games, which I want to come back to that. But like, yeah, so like, so that there was also, I ran like a little like one-shot, two-shot where it was like a traveling group of performers, and so they had like this weird like. It was sort of like Howl's Moving Castle, but like a lot smaller, right? Like, mm-hmm. think about that. But they had like this, you know, this mount that was almost like a thing that they could ride on,
sure.
As well. Like, and so I really like this concept. I think for me, where these things fall down, especially in like fantasy, like, yeah, and like more tactical games, is like the mechanical advantage that they can give you, right? Because yeah. like, I've had players that, like, you know, they want to jump on a horse, right, and do stuff, and it's like, well, how do we, you know, like, yeah, like, how do we like, yeah, weave that into the narrative, you know, and like figure out the mechanics of it too, without it being like taking away from the experience of what's happening at the table. Right. Yeah. So like in the example of like the familiars for, you know, like with warlocks and stuff, like that can give them such a huge mechanical advantage. It can kind of break dungeons in a way, right? If you can have this thing that can fly around ahead of you and kind of scope things out, and or like, yeah, or fly up and into the air and kind of see down on what's you know, what's going on for you too, because it's like not everybody can do that, but then you have sort of this like all-seeing eye that you've inserted into the scene
yeah.
too, right? So like there's what I found is like when those things start to get interjected, it can become antagonistic between the GM and the players a little bit. At least this is more a me thing than anything. It's like, yeah, like, okay, yes, you have this familiar that you can send out to like go like scope around, but like that takes away a lot of the fun of this yes. experience, right? Yeah, so I don't want you to have that necessarily, right? Because it's like, well, okay, you've solved this problem with your hammer, but I think it would be more fun if you didn't have that hammer.
Yeah, exactly. And I've had very similar experiences with things like, you know, a bird that you can see through their eyes or something, and mm-hmm. one player yeah. has it, and that experience at the table of like you've got this dungeon or this adventure, and you just didn't account for the fact that like they were going to be able to scope out every room before they got to it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, okay, fair enough. It's a thing they chose. They should be able to use it, but it is disproportionately changing like how they are. It's just, they are now experiencing this dungeon in a very different way than I designed it
mm-hmm.
to be experienced. Yeah. And is that on me? It is. Does it feel like one stupid detail is like exerting an overwhelming amount of impact on the adventure, yes. But thinking about mounts, so I will confess, I don't really like mounts in role-playing games. And again, talking like D&D type adventure-y games. And my experience with it was set pretty strongly when I was a young GM. And I was playing in, I was running games in a system where mounted combat gave you a huge battlefield advantage over unmounted foes. So all of the players, and I'm just talking sheer numbers. So this is like Rolemaster and Millith role playing. I mean, if you were charging a goblin on a horse, you know, with a spear or whatever, you were just going to slaughter that thing in a way that you weren't going to be able to do if you were down on the ground, like, you know, melee combating it. So players have this mechanical incentive to have mounts. And it makes sense, right? People in fantasy stories have horses, right? It's a people in medieval, you know, adventures in middle medieval settings have horses. But what I found is I was just faced with that choice of like, okay, now every combat needs to be like every cool combat scene I come up with needs to be rethought to take into account that it's now going to be like a bunch of heavily armed mounted warriors, like, you know, sprinting huge distances with incredible mobility. And so I've got to like, we're in this arms race now. I'm going to have to, you know, now the goblins all have to have mounts or whatever, right? So you have that tactical consideration that starts to flavor everything. And then I started to get irritated because an awful lot of like D&D adventuring just doesn't, D&D adventuring just doesn't really have room for like somebody to have a horse along with them. You know, because when they go in the dungeon, the horse is not going down into the dungeon with them, right? So they've got to like park the horse out somewhere. Now the bad guys, that's a big vulnerability. So now every time we do this, the bad guys are going to have to try and take out the horse or what. I mean, it just, now I'm thinking about all this stuff that's not the dungeon that was exciting. You know, well, the PCs have this vulnerability. I need to exploit it. What I'm trying to say is, having those horses was cool and it felt mostly in genre, but it just did not feel like the game was really meant for you to have a mount in any sort of tactical situation. And so I started to resent it, and I kind of, I kind of would steer people away from character classes that came with mounts or whatever. And I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a, I mean, you know, like you mentioned, though, like you got to park your horse when you go in the dungeon, that sort of stuff. It's like, you know, and I mean, if you then as a GM, like really, really went hard on that and like they came back up and their horse was dead, like that's worse than killing, I think, off a character. Right? Yeah, like you can't, right? Like it's just like there's a little bit of plot armor, I think, that comes along with, with mounts and like, things like that, unless they can easily come back. So it's like, it's weird. And then, I mean, like going back to Elden Ring, for example, right? It's the spectral horse that can kind of like come in and out of the plane of existence that you are. So like in Elden Ring, it's very like, there are just walls and dungeons where it's like, you can't have a horse past this wall. You know, so like that's how it gets around it. Cause like, it'd be the same thing in a video game, right? If you could always have access to mounted combat, right? It would change everything. And like, it just wouldn't make sense. So I mean, they're just like some, I think, you're right on. There are like so many practical considerations that go into that. It's like, I don't know. It's like adding like a new piece of technology to a game, right? Like if you had D&D, but also someone had a Gatling gun, right? It would be a very different game, right? Like same thing, like, but one of your players has a horse. It's like, well, okay, like you all need horses then, right? If we're going to do this. And then it also, like, there is just the simulation aspect too. Like, I mean, you mentioned like, you know, charging down a goblin with a spear or something, like, but also like if the goblin can dodge out of the way, like it has a huge mobility advantage of like kind of going, you know, left and right or like up a tree and stuff, but you're on a horse, right? So just like, it just increases the problem space, I think, of like running a tactical game so much that it's like, the thing that's fun about it without the mounts is no longer fun about it with the mounts.
It reminds me of, I think there are other ways this kind of thing can happen. So here's another example of this kind of problem, although it has nothing to do with mounts. Mm-hmm. If you have players, they're going through a dungeon, and one of them is a really sneaky rogue, and so the rogue is scouting ahead constantly. Mm-hmm. Is that make sense for them to do? It does. Mm-hmm. Does it? I mean, and I guess we're kind of talking about that. If I have a bird who I can see through their eyes, does it affect every single encounter now because your rogue is doing the realistic, plausible thing of scouting ahead, but now you can't you can't ambush the players like you're hoping, you can't surprise them with like a stunning vista or mm-hmm. something because your scout saw it first and then reported it back to the party. Yeah. So you know, when that happens, you know, my mind goes to, can I abstract this into a mechanical advantage so we don't have to waste time role playing through the scout, like scouting ahead mm-hmm. and just at every single room and bring the whole game screeching to a halt. Mm-hmm. Can I abstract this? So could I just represent this with like, well, if you say you're always scouting ahead, I'm just going to give the whole party a blanket +2 to perception against being surprised or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I like that because then it lets me push away this kind of irritating element that I don't want to deal with the simulationist aspects of it. Mm-hmm. But it is, you know, I am then you are tossing the simulation part off to the side mm-hmm. because what you're dealing with is like now this kind of abstracted experience that doesn't really represent what the player characters are really experiencing, which is that their friend is reporting back to them that in the room ahead there's a chasm and he timed the guard, you know, he timed when the guards come through it and stuff like that. Yeah. So I feel like that with mounts, you know, like, so my brain wants to be like, well, you've all got mounts. I don't really want to play out what it means to have a mount all the time. So what mm-hmm. if we, whatever, what if just in any outdoor space, your speed is all +10 movement mm-hmm. per turn, right? Yeah. That sounds pretty boring and weak, but like, that's where my mind wants to go because I don't want to deal with like the practicalities of a mount. So thoughts?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think you're reaching for a solution that I think makes a lot of sense, but it does also sort of remove some of the fun, right? It's like if I pick a rogue character, and I just had this happen last week. I was playing in a game with some friends, and like I'm like a rogue character, right? So it's exactly what you're saying. It's like I'm sneaking ahead and making a lot of rolls for, am I stealthy, right? Like am I staying stealthy? Am I able to find information? And like, you know, so the GM is doing a really good job of like, you know, making sure that we have sort of different information, right? So it's like I have information, but I haven't gotten back to them yet to relay it to them, but then they have information that they haven't told me, right? So like there's a you can play a little bit with that information disparity, I think, in like the rogue example. It's harder when it's like the familiar, where it's just like, I don't know, you just have sort of like a roving security camera, right? So you're just like, you know, kind of repeating back everything. But like, yeah, so I think like, yeah, so like I wouldn't want to like remove the, hey, you just all get +2 on whatever perception rolls. Like that feels like that diminishes why someone wants to be a rogue.
Yes.
But like, I absolutely hear you with like the mount is just this, like, it's just like such a different thing. It's like you almost want to just say like, yes, you can have a horse, you can name your horse, we can talk about the horse, but the horse gives you no mechanical advantage, right? Kind of want to just say that it's like, just because like this is not going to be supported very well, and we're just going to constantly run into these like frictions of it. Or maybe you make the rule with them. It's like, if you have a horse and you want to use it to a mechanical advantage, then I'm going to treat the horse sort of like any other character in your party, in that like it needs to, it's going to roll initiative. Like I'm going to try to attack it. Like, you know, like,
right.
Yeah. If a horse is a rare thing in the world, like everybody is going to want to steal that horse. Right. It's just like, there's stuff you can add, I think, on top of it, role-playing game wise, but it's just like at a certain point you're like, well, okay, are we having fun anymore? Is now the horse sort of this thing that we're passing off? Like we're putting more friction and more conflict on this thing than what you really want out of it, which is like, I want to name the horse Chestnut.
Right.
yeah.
Well, like, that's interesting. You know, I'm kind of drawn to the idea of like, you know, why do you want the horse, right? Is it mm-hmm. is it just part of your vision for the character? Is it impossible for this kind of character, you know, to exist in this setting without a horse, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you excited about the tactical advantages it will bring? Mm-hmm. Or are you just excited because you're going to have a horse? You know, mm-hmm. can we represent the horse's presence, the mount's presence in the party in some way that doesn't make it like the pivot of every tactical encounter, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I think thinking Elden Ring. So I got excited when you started talking about the Elden Ring mount because I wasn't really thinking about what mounts do in video games. But mm-hmm. in Elden Ring, getting that mount is very exciting and fun. It mm-hmm. it makes the game more fun to have it because the game world it lets the game designers say what like well it just adds stuff you can do that's fun.
Mm-hmm.
It now the game can have places that you need a mount to get to. That's exciting from like the game designer perspective because now you can make stuff that you couldn't think of a way that a person on foot could get up here, but if they have a mount that can double jump or jump in those horse launchers that Elden Ring has, which are just delightful. So that's like, you know, it's like a purely additive thing. And because it's a video game, Elden Ring, you know, like you say, you cross the line, you cross a glowing blue line when you go into a dungeon and your horse just, you know, vanishes off the screen.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, so you don't have to find a tree to hook it up to or whatever like that, yeah. you know? So it's like this purely additive thing that a video game just takes away and doesn't feel any need to explain to you why it's doing it.
Yeah.
Your horse vanished and you are now just standing on your own two feet. Mm-hmm. I think in a typical D&D game, you know, that's too video gamey to do something purely like that. Like this is a no horse zone.
Yeah,
you know, your horses dematerialize until you, you know,
yes.
But I do kind of wonder, like, if you have the right group, could you just be up front and be like, we are going to handle mounts in a way that is not like realistic, but in a way that is going to let you celebrate having a mount at times, but let me like just nix it when it's going to make my life as a GM. When it's going to like sap all the fun out of my GMing, you know,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, most of the people I play with would probably be fine with that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That might feel a little like just generally unsatisfying though, because you're really just cheating your way out of a problem that feels like it should have a more elegant solution.
Yeah. Yeah. It is very tricky. Cause I mean, I think there is some fun to be had. Like, I don't know, like if you are, it's like fun in small doses, right? Like it would be very fun to have a session where it's like, okay, you all have horses and you're, you know, you're fighting a bunch of other people that have horses, right? Like, so then combat can feel very different. Feel very different. Cause it's like, okay, you're charging across a battlefield, like at each other. It's like, and your wizards firing off magic missiles and stuff from horseback. It's like that sounds super fun to me, but like, yeah, but it's like if every combat is that way, it's like, yeah, then you're, I don't know, you're playing a very different game at that point. Yeah, I think like, okay, so I think my advice to GMs would probably be like, maybe try to not have mounts, but if you do, you know, try to have some good clear rules around like when they can be used and when they can't be used.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hold on one second.
I wonder if you could take inspiration just from the way the game handles other game changing things. Like you mm-hmm. can't, until you're very high level, you might be able to fly for some time during mm-hmm. an adventuring day, but you can't fly all the time because that would just wreck every published adventure if you were just could free fly anywhere you wanted.
Yeah.
So whatever. So the fly spell has a limited duration and it uses up a spell slot and all that stuff. Like, so you have those limits built in. It's like a special power because mm-hmm. it lets you break the game for a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, are there ways without just totally throwing simulation to the side? Are there ways that whatever you can call on your mount twice, like your mount can be in two encounters per day.
Yeah.
Before it gets exhausted or, you know, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Just put a tight limit on it so that it feels really awesome when you're like, this is a important fight. I am getting on Smokey the horse here.
Yeah.
You know, to fight this boss battle. but it isn't like, you know, it's not an ever-present thing. In the same way, if like one player was just permanently flying and none of the others were, that would get old almost instantly. And yeah, you would be desperate to strip that power away from the player.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think like, I don't know enough about like real world battle tactics to know the answer to this, but I'm sure if faced with mounted combat over and over, like your enemy's going to figure out ways to sort of make that less fun for you. You know, and like have defenses for it. And again, like if you're going back to like you have sort of a named mount, like you're not going to want to put it in danger that often. Yeah. So maybe it's like you get away with this once, but then the next time, like, you know, any surviving goblins have spread the word like, hey, these people have these horses that they're using. I'm also thinking about like in like Lord of the Rings, like, right, like the horses just like bolt right at certain points. Like Bill the Pony is the only one that makes it back. Right. Like, and it's a very, very cool thing. Like Bill the Pony almost has like its own personality, in that story. Right. But like, for the most part, they're used to sort of get around a little bit, but also to carry stuff as well. Like same thing in The Hobbit, right? Like, you know, towards the end of it, there's a pony that Bilbo is taking back, and like they find some gold that they had stashed with the troll, like where they encountered the trolls. And they're just like, well, I don't know. Like, there's a conversation about, like, can the pony handle more weight to, like, take it back?
Yeah. Right?
So then you get into some, like, more interesting, like, mechanics at that point. Like, and then it's like, well, then Bilbo has to walk the last, you know, couple, whatever, 100 miles to get home. It's like, okay, well, I mean, that's cool. But again, you're sort of, like, layering on top of an existing system more and more rules for how to handle it. So I like what you were saying with just, like, you get basically like the equivalent of spell slots for your mount. Like it can do a handful of things for you per session, but it's not going to just be there all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I do think, you know, mounts are much more manageable when you are treating them as like a strategic resource, not a tactical resource.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's, it could be very rewarding if, you know, your players have mounts that never or rarely take part in like tactical situations, but as a strategic resource. Oh yeah, you can travel 2 extra hexes a day if you've got mounts, and you can carry plus X pounds of treasure and extend your stays before you have to go back to town. And as a strategic resource, because like travel and survival and stuff we've talked about, you know, that tends to be more abstracted. And like a horse can be, a mount could be another abstract bonus or penalty or whatever in that figure. You would just have to have an answer for like why they can't, you know, mount the horse when the goblins attack.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, maybe it's the horse is scared of goblins.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So hey, we need to we need to wrap up here in a minute. So yeah, did you have any final thoughts on the question of mounts? And we've really been drilling down on like, you know, horses, but I think this conversation touches on like all of those extra things PCs might want to bring in for perfectly good reasons that just seem to add more complications without adding an equal amount of fun.
Yeah.
So do you have any kind of final thoughts on how you might approach that sort of a problem?
Yeah, I think my only final thought that I'm kind of coalescing around is like, so either your mount has sort of no in-game mechanics, like just sort of a cosmetic, or if you're going to have it be something that can have mechanical advantages, I think you need to have some pretty tight rules with it. And I might even go so far as to say that it should have its own character sheet, right? That you like the player has to manage, or maybe you just have one player that just really loves horses, right? And they just play that as a character, right? I think you like, I'm kind of coming down to like, if you're going to do it, you really need to lean on the mechanics, like the existing mechanics, and have it sort of fit in there. So like your horse is a level one horse. It's got, you know, 10 hit points and can run, you know, like its movement speed is 120, you know, 120, like whatever meters per turn. Like, right. Like just really like leaning into that to make it like clear. It's like, you know, this is something that exists, but it's also not just this freebie that you sort of get to use as a role playing get out of jail free card.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to find that balance. You do not ever want to just slap down something that a player that brings joy to a player, I think, as you know, and having a horse in a fantasy campaign that is not outside the genre. Your player is not trying to abuse anything by wanting a horse or whatever, but you do need to have some kind of negotiation, I think, where it's like, this can't be the center. This can't be like centered all the time. Mm-hmm. How can we make it be something like special that makes you glad you chose this option on your character sheet, but that doesn't, you know, have all of us waiting around, like, you know, like waiting for the rogue to scout every single room and come back and report, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
All right. Well, that's good stuff. All right.
Any closing notes? What else do we need to cover?
Nope. That's it. Yeah. So this has been a really good conversation. Yeah. So we've been Roll for Topic. We're part of the Roll for It Media Podcasting Network. Our sister show, The Splat Book, with John, Jess, and Ben is great. I listened to a recent episode of theirs where they had the guy that wrote the new Moria campaign book for the One Ring.
Yes. Was that Gareth Hanrahan?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it was a really good conversation. Loved hearing it. I mean, you can always tell when someone is like really into the thing that they're doing. And like Gar is absolutely like, he loves it. Like, he loves talking about it. He loves thinking about it. Like, Jess asked him one question that just like kind of stopped him in his tracks. And he just like, he got this like light in his voice of like, oh my goodness, that's such a good question. So that was a good one to
definitely. It was awesome. Gareth, and I'm pronouncing his name wrong. His name is on some of my favorite game stuff that's come out in the last decade. Like, he's just a great brain.
It's so cool that they got him on. So yeah, go listen to that. And then you can also go check out Zombie Strains with Andy and John as well. It's really good. Listen to the Shaun of the Dead episode recently and loved it. Shaun of the Dead's my favorite. Like, yeah. So they were.
I was nervous when we recorded that. I'm glad to hear you liked it because I know how much you like this movie. And I mean, we liked it too. So it's not like we're trashing it, but at the same time, I don't know. I'm pleased that you enjoyed listening to us talk about it.
I did, weren't
screaming at your iPad or whatever too much while listening.
No, not too much. I mean, certain things that, like, I mean, I know, right? Like, you only can record for so long, but like, there's certain things that I want to be like, oh, we like really need to like drill down into this, like all the little nuances that are happening in the scene, and it's like it's fine, you know. Like, that's not the point of Zombie Strains. So you'll go listen to Zombie Strains. It's really good, especially if you like zombie movies. If you don't like zombie movies, I think it's a really good like kind of recap and discussion about what zombie movies are all about. So
that's kind of you to say, Chris. Thanks.
All right, well, I think that does it for us. I've been Chris Salzman,
and I've been Andy Rao.
Remember, if your player is having fun, you're a great GM.